Patsy with the Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing. And for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book, coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Oh boy, this is going to be a fun day. At the bottom of the hour, I have Dwayne Reed, Mr. Reed. He is a teacher, and he has written a really fascinating book. It's called Simon B. Ryman. I am not going to embarrass myself by trying to do any rap, but I'm sure he's going to do it for us, and I'm looking forward to having him at the bottom of the hour. But right now, I want to start with an author who, it's always exciting when an author just starts off and it's her debut and a book and it's a big deal. And in this case, it is a very big deal. I mean, sometimes you get big deals and you get really big deals. And Sarah Penner has written a book called The Lost Apothecary. And I don't know, it was named the most anticipated book of 2021 by Oprah Magazine, Newsweek, Good Housekeeping, Pop Sugar, I don't know, all sorts of places. And I have been waiting and I've been anticipating this interview because I got the book early, and I am so happy to welcome Sarah to the program. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Patsy. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Oh, wow. You know, there's so many things I love about this book. First of all, I love any book set in England. I love books with parallel storylines. I love the 18th century England part. I'm not sure which one I love the most, but it's just, it's so much fun.
It sounds like the book has all of the different elements that you love then. So it was a great fit.
Exactly. And they're right there. You know, I lived in England for quite a while. I had a cottage there. And so I know England very well. And I was thinking, I never did this wonderful thing that you did in London.
Are you referring to mudlarking?
Yes, you have to tell us all about that, how you got this wonderful idea, and then of course some of your research, because I did do a lot of research in the same places that you did. I know that I spent a lot of time at the reading room in the British Museum Library, hundreds of hours there, and also in the other libraries in town, and in the rare book room. So, but first, here you are. I mean, you must be really excited. You know, you have this wonderful release with all this anticipation by major, major people. It's exciting.
Yeah. It has been such a wonderful experience. I mean, I think debuting in a pandemic environment has been strange and challenging, but I truly cannot express enough gratitude and excitement about just all of the buzz. You mentioned a few of the most anticipated lists, and then it was announced earlier this week that it was it's a book of the month pick for March. An Amazon featured debut, an editor's pick. There's just been all kinds of really wonderful accolades. And you mentioned a minute ago that you didn't go mudlarking in London. And I think I want to make sure people know what mudlarking is, because this is how the story begins. And basically, mudlarking means scrounging around along a body of water for anything interesting or valuable that maybe the tide has brought in or turned over. And of course, at the beginning of The Lost Apothecary, the present-day character, she goes mudlarking along the River Thames in London, and she finds this old mysterious apothecary vial, and she suspects that she has identified the culprit in the never-solved apothecary murders that haunted London two centuries prior. And so then we are also in the story introduced to this apothecary who lived and worked in 1791, and she was not just any everyday apothecary. She actually sells well-disguised poisons to women seeking vengeance on the men who have wronged them. Uh-huh. And so the entire book, very, very cool premise. It was so much fun to research. And I learned all about poisons and plants and toxics, all kinds of cool stuff.
Well, I like a little bit worried that there was a lot of anticipation for this book. A few too many women are interested in this poisoning idea. But
I know.
You know, I don't know. There is a dark side, as you have developed in this book. But your character in the modern day part of the book is named Carolyn Parswell, and she's a historian, and so it's just right up her alley here to come out. You know, she finds something that intrigues her, and as somebody like yourself, you know, when I'm like that too. If I find something, I want to know more about it. And so Caroline, she's supposed to be on her 10th wedding anniversary.
Yep.
I'm not sure how much we want to tell people about it, but it's not exactly what she had planned. And there she is in London.
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, she's at a transition in her life, and just like you said, it's her 10th wedding anniversary, but she is in London alone, which is not what she expected. And so it's an opportunity, this time by herself is an opportunity for her to do some digging, both literally and figuratively. So she's digging into a mystery. She's digging in the mud when she goes mudlarking. But then she's also digging into herself and kind of asking herself, what dreams and passions have I had over the course of my life, and what has been buried or covered up because I have a life to live and a husband and a responsible job? And so she really starts to unbury some of those things that she's hidden within herself.
Oh, it's a very complicated, deep story into life and into what is going on in our lives. But you tell it, it's actually rather... I don't know why I found it actually rather amusing. I'm not sure if I perhaps, you know, we could all be losing it. The 18th century part, 1791, of course. This is a strange time in England, where there's a lot of darkness there in the back alleys of London.
Yeah, definitely. So this 1791, the monarch on the throne was King George III, and you really don't see this era discussed much in commercial fiction. So commercial fiction tends to be Victorian or World War II or the Tudors and, you know, Anne Boleyn, but you really don't see much George in London. And I really think it's an untapped area in fiction, because it was so scandalous and, like you just said, kind of dark and enchanting. So, you know, people talk about the gin craze when there was just astronomical death rates due to consumption of gin and liquor. You had all sorts of brothels and police corruption. It was pre-industrial revolution, so you had a lot of workhouses and child labor. There was just a lot of really dark stuff going on at this time. And the other reason that was very serendipitous, and I learned this quickly in my research, the other reason I set the book in the era that I did was because we as a society did not have forensic toxicology and the science to detect poisons during an autopsy. That did not exist until about 50 years after the book was set. And so for a sinister apothecary like the one in my story to dispense poisons, she was able to get away with that behavior and that work in 1791. But even 50 years later, she would not have been able to do that, because police and coroners would have quickly realized something's going on. All of these dead men are showing up and they've been poisoned. And so the era that I chose to set the story was a perfect confluence of this era that I personally find fascinating and have researched extensively, but also it made sense for an apothecary poisoner to exist.
And research, you must have done some really great research, because you write about it so easily and really make it very graphic. So tell us how. So there you came out with this idea because of your own mudlarking, and then you set your character to do some mudlarking. And how did you then go about doing the start the research for this? I mean, right away, did you know you're going to write this book?
Yeah, so the very first seed of an idea was I knew I wanted an apothecary in old London, that I wanted there to be something sinister and secretive about her. And so that immediately brought me into the world of poison, because what else would an apothecary do, or how would she run her business if she was sinister, unless it was poison? And so the wonderful thing is that there are countless resources and books and websites that go into great detail about which toxins in our everyday environment are poisonous, and a lot of those are plants. So I learned all sorts of interesting information about herbalism and different household plants and what the toxins are inside of those. And so the thing is, I had to stay away from chemical names, because in the 18th century, an apothecary would not have called something by its chemical name. She would have called it by its plant or its Latin name. So I was looking through all sorts of documents and actual encyclopedias pulled together several hundred years ago so that I could stay true to what an apothecary would have called that specific remedy or ingredient. And so that was fun, because there's a lot of digitized documents online, and this is such a wonderful thing for historical fiction authors, that a lot of old manuscripts and resources have been digitized by libraries and museums across the world. So I was able to look at these primary firsthand accounts and resources to dig into how really did an apothecary run her shop, and what would she have been writing on the little tiny labels on all of her vials. So it was absolutely fascinating research.
Now, this is your first book published. Had you written before? Because you're a fine writer.
Well, thank you. I have no formal writing experience. However, I think many authors, I feel like so many of us have a manuscript or two in the bottom of our desk drawer that will never see the light of day. And that was certainly my experience. So about 5 years ago, I wrote a historical fiction book, and I queried more than 100 agents, and I got rejection after rejection. So that manuscript was never agented. It was certainly never published, and it is kind of hidden away and will probably never see the light of day. But I knew enough from being a part of the writing community and talking to successful authors. I knew that the most important thing is persistence, and you have to try again. And so I took feedback from others about why the first book wasn't working, and I incorporated that feedback into The Lost Apothecary, and I started this brand new story. And I was so fortunate that I actually received 5 agent offers on The Lost Apothecary, and then once we actually put it on submission, it sold overnight to Park Row Books. So it was very much a success story.
A big success story, because you've gotten really, enormous coverage, and I'm sure it'll turn into a film. But the exciting thing is that you were persistent, because one of the things that, I talk to a lot of my listeners are people who are just starting off writing, many of them because I encourage them. And they finish a book and they think that's it. They think, they're going to start, it's going to be immediately accepted. And to hear that somebody actually queried 100 times, I think that helps them to understand the process. You have to be persistent.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I can't think of a single writer friend of mine who has had their very first manuscript agented and published right out the gate. I would say every author I know has had at least one, if not 2, 3, 4 manuscripts that didn't hit the mark, and so they just kept trying. And you get better with every manuscript you write, and I would say that you also write a little bit faster because you have more of a basic understanding of how to structure
a story. That was certainly the case for me. I was able to write The Lost Apothecary, you know, fairly quick compared to my first attempt. But I would say encouragement, or, you know, as a form of encouragement, just find your community. I gave this piece of advice yesterday during my virtual launch party, that to any aspiring or new writers, you absolutely have to find like-minded people who are waking up every day, or, you know, early, or staying up late to just get words on a page. Writing can feel very lonely, and so you have to find your community of friends. There's all sorts of virtual groups that we can do, and then once the pandemic is behind us, there's lots of writing circles in any city, or online, and just find your people, interact on social media. I have a huge presence on Twitter, and try to interact regularly with writers on Twitter. And just find your people, because they're going to be the ones to support you and help you along as you do face those inevitable rejections.
So did you have beta readers before you presented it to an agent? Did you go through that process?
Yes, I did. And in fact, one of my beta readers is Brooke Allen, and she has been on your show, and she was actually the one that referred you to me. And she was one of my first readers. I probably had about 10 people read my first couple of chapters. Those first chapters are so important, because you have to hook an agent immediately. They're not going to keep reading. So I had more people read the first couple of chapters, and then I had just a few very trusted people, about 3 or 4, who read the entire manuscript and they gave great feedback, and I looked for themes. So anytime you've got beta readers or critique readers, you don't want to just make a list of every single piece of feedback you get and then go start making changes. I think it's important to look for themes. So if 3 of your 4 beta readers are saying, I want more background information on this particular character, you should probably listen to that, because they all had the same opinion. But if one beta reader has a critique that just doesn't sit well with you, and none of the others commented on that, you could maybe let that one go. That's kind of up to you. But I definitely believe in the importance of beta readers.
And then you obviously submitted it. You did a query letter to a number of people to get 5 agents after you. That's pretty good.
Yeah, it was a really great response. I pitched 2 of the agents in person, because this was long before COVID. So I pitched 2 of the agents in person, and they one of them made an offer, and then in the days to follow, 4 other agents that I queried kind of through the slush pile, they also offered. So I was in the very difficult but enviable position of getting to choose from 5 different agents.
Definitely a wonderful position to be in. And some agent is very happy. We have to, you know, just they have to know that they have a hit here on their hands. And as I said, I used to write scripts. I always, if I see it in my head as a film, then I know it's a winner, because I forget it's a book, you know, and it just sort of plays in my head. It's very exciting. And I'm sure that somebody's going to pick it up, because it's got everything there, that you know, the history, the mystery, great characters. I am really, really thrilled that I've been able to speak to you today, because, you know, it is so much fun always when an author is just starting off, and to get to know them from the beginning and get to know their work from the beginning. I just love it. I get such a thrill watching over the years. I've had a few authors who my 6th anniversary of Joy on Paper is on March 16th. And you know, in 6 years, I've interviewed so many authors, and so many of the ones that I've done, you know, their very first book, and I've followed them through the years. It's so exciting to see how they progress and develop and get better and better and just have more and more fun with writing. And you certainly have done that. And I'm so glad that Brooke Allen, you know, of course, I love Brooke Allen. I love her Antonia series. you know, she's a remarkable author, and but I'm so thrilled that she sent you to me, because I think you're a terrific writer, and I know you probably working on something right now.
Well, thank you so much, Patsy. You know, I think those of us who love writing, we rarely find ourselves not working on a project. So I am, as you say, I am working on something new. I can't share much about it, but I can tell you that so many of the elements that people have come to love in The Lost Apothecary, like the atmospheric historical setting, the themes of women's empowerment, the mystery and the cliffhangers, that's all where I naturally fall as a writer. And so I can assure readers who love The Lost Apothecary, they will love what's coming next as well.
Well, I'm sure they will. Now, as you said, you're on Twitter, and you have a great webpage. Very nice.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I'm on all social media, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And sarahpenner.com is my website. And then I've even got some videos up on YouTube, some features on my rare books and my personal library. There's an audiobook teaser of The Lost Apothecary if you want to hear the narrators. So there's a few cool videos up there as well. But I'm definitely not difficult to find online.
Well, I can see that you're very savvy about publicity and about marketing, because that's what an author has to do today too. It's not
that's
enough
right,
to just be a writer, is it?
You've really got to do it all. You know, publicists and marketers are just notoriously overworked, and so as an author, you really have to own your own, you know, self-marketing, and you have to be willing and able to get out there and promote yourself. And I have worked in corporate finance for so many years that I'm very used to kind of the being talking in front of people, presenting in front of business leaders. And so, of course, the audience is different now because it's readers and bookstores and things like that. But I think that the marketing is actually, I really have enjoyed it, because I think it's kind of fun, and it's something different than, you know, writing words on a page and kind of that creative element of developing a story.
Okay, before I have to let you go, because I could talk to you for an hour easily, but before I have to let you go, is there one person that you want to thank for encouraging you to write? One person in your life?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, there is one person. My dad, he actually passed away in 2015, but he is one of both of my parents. You know, they really encouraged me to have this love of language, and they encouraged me to write young. And I really have been interested in writing and language generally speaking my whole life because of my parents. And so they would definitely, my book is dedicated to them. And then they're the last people that I thank in the acknowledgments as well. You know, my parents have been such an important part of this whole journey.
Well, Sarah Penner, I think you are on the road to success as a writer, and it's going to be a fun journey with you. And I hope you keep me right there on your list and make sure that I get, you know, advanced. One of the joys for me of doing Joy on Paper is I get advanced copies. So please, please keep me on your list, and you'll be back here when the next book is ready to be released, okay?
That's right. Thank you so much, Patsy, for having me today. This has been great.
Okay. Bye-bye now, Sarah. Wow.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye. She is great. All right. Wow. On Oprah's list on Amazon's number one book for the month. What can you do? Okay, everybody, we're going to have a book buzz and then a commercial, and then I'm coming back with a teacher who's going to teach us perhaps how to do a little bit of rapping.
Okay. Hey, everyone, it's Devon Miller, author and illustrator of the Mr. Tickety-Tock Clock children's book series, reporting for Joy on Paper with the latest on children's book buzz. The month of February is also known as Black History Month, and before the month ended, a new book was released, and you probably saw it on Good Morning America. The book I'm talking about is REJ's Kinky Curly Crown, written by Ayeen Haith Drew and illustrated by Shamar Knight Justice. Having been an educator for nearly over a decade, Ayeen saw how much of an impact literature had on her children while she was in the classroom. Knowing Shamar from a school they both worked at, she picked Shamar to do her illustrations for REJ, making this book his debut as a children's illustrator and Ayin's debut as a children's author. Based on Ayin's niece of the same name, the book tells the story of first grader REJ. She had the perfect clothes, glasses, grades, friends, and even teacher, but the only thing not so perfect she noticed was her wild, unruly hair. When reading REJ's Kinky Curly Crown, you'll see beautifully illustrated characters in the book, all with different hairstyles along the way, and the book serves as a great reminder to embrace what makes you special. I remember my hair was becoming a little wild and curly than it should have been during quarantine, but let me tell you guys that a haircut for me was a trick to embracing my true hairstyle. This is Devon Miller reporting for Joy on Paper. For more book buzz involving children's books and authors, head on over to radio-joyonpaper.com and click on Devon Miller's Book Buzzes. I think it's about time that I buzz out now.
This is the TAN Talk Radio Network.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
Have you ever faced disaster? The Red Cross is always there for you. The Red Cross responds to a call for help every 8 seconds. They have never turned anyone down. Now they need your financial support so that they can be ready to help you when the need arises. Donate online at redcross.org. Thank you.
This is the TAN Talk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I am back with my next guest. In a few minutes, he's going to be on, and it's going to be Dwayne Reed, and he is Mr. Reed, the teacher of, he is famous now. He has all his YouTube rap videos are doing, it's, I don't know, 5 million people watching, and he has 50,000 followers. So it's really exciting to be able to talk to him today about his book. And it's, you know. Anyway, meanwhile, while we're waiting for him, just want to remind you my webpage, radio-joyonpaper, is where you can see or listen to many of the interviews that I have done in the past 6 years. My goodness, 6 years of interviews. Over 250 New York Times bestsellers, authors, 11 Mystery Writer of America Grandmasters, I don't know how many hundreds of indie authors, and all of them have been just wonderful, wonderful guests on my program. And over the next few months, I hope to bring many of them back, the ones who were with me on the very first year, because I want to see how they've progressed, and what's happening with them. So this is going to be fun. I have a lot of plans. One of the things that I really enjoyed a few weeks ago, I had a narrator on, of course. You know, Nicholas Guy Smith is one of the most famous narrators, and he was with me to do Keats. But now I have somebody, and I don't know if he's going to rap. He's going to rap for me. Simon B. Ryman is a new book by Dwayne Reed, And Mr. Reed is a teacher and a rapper. And it's so nice to welcome you to the programs, Dwayne.
Awesome. Hey, thank you so much for having me, Patsy.
Okay, well, you're going to have to do some rapping for me. You know, when my kids were little, I attempted to wake them up with rap. And I think my youngest son, I think he was maybe like 5 years old, and he said to me, and he looked up from his, they had a bunk bed, and he was on the bottom bunk, and he looked up at me, and he said, "Pathetic." Oh, boy, that was the end of my rapping.
Man, tough critic, but you know, so often, my fourth and fifth graders, they're really tough critics as well, but usually they give me a good rating.
Well, so I'm sure. Well, you get good ratings. I mean, my goodness, you have so many viewers to your YouTube. Why don't we call them little snippets that you do to help encourage kids and just to get that love of reading and education into them. And you're getting a lot of viewers.
Yeah, that's been cool. Kind of like Simon, and I'll tell you a little bit more about him, but I've always dreamed of being on the big stage and having people, you know, be moved by my words. So it's cool to have tons of kids and young people and even, you know, parents and adults listening to my songs, watching my videos, and it feels good that something positive is coming from it.
Well, you're so charming. It's so delightful to watch these little videos. And, of course, the book, Simon Be Rhymin', is, I love the cover. It's just a great cover. And, you know, now I'm going to tell you the truth. I had to read the book twice because if I am the kind of person who I correct grammar. I was a homeschool mom, so my kids raised, they could never ask me, can I, you know, have a cookie? So for me, the way that you write, of course, is not grammatically what I'm used to. Let's put it that way. And I mean, I would correct James Joyce's grammar when I was reading James Joyce. So you know, I'm just that kind of a person. But it is fun, and I loved what really got me into it, and I just loved it, were that you had all these little sections where Simon's raps are, and they're set sometimes to, you mentioned the tune, the music, and so I could get into it. And once I started that, then when I went back and read the book the second time, I really could enjoy it and get that sort of rhythm that you put into the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the way that my scholars speak and the way that I spoke when I was growing up, you know, we have to recognize where we're at. And the way I speak with my scholars isn't the same way that I speak when I'm, you know, at an interview or when I'm, you know, online speaking in front of people. You know, we code switch. But I wanted Simon's story to be authentic. So you do hear a lot of slang. And you do hear, you know, him taking the G's off some of the words, because that's real, right? That's real, and that's how my scholars communicate, you know, amongst themselves, and that's how I communicate with them. So it's funny, I was talking to one of my kids one day, and they said, "Mr. Reed, you sound different when you in class, but when you be up on the TV, you sound completely different." And that's just how we got to get down sometimes.
Well, it is amusing, and but throughout the book, one of the wonderful things about it is the strength that you put into, particularly his father, and I love the relationship and how the father is so encouraging, and let's says, you know, this is okay. You sometimes you don't have to be a big talker, but you have to just have this great heart. And I love this storyline.
Yeah. So I didn't have a biological father. Well, I had him, but he wasn't in my life. And I didn't get to have the relationship that I've seen so many of my peers have with their dads. My mom was really strong, and I definitely like to talk about that. But not having a dad impacted me, I think adversely, negatively. And there were so many things that I felt like I missed out on. So in bringing in Simon's dad, I really wanted to convey this idea that, one, Black fathers are involved. Number two, the level of involvement of Black fathers in their children's lives is above and beyond. They take a space up in their child's heart that is, you can't match this anywhere else, I think. And I wrote Simon's dad to be what I wish that my dad was in my life. And this isn't a knock at my biological dad whatsoever. This is just saying, man, I wish I had someone like this. And I think it'll be really important for readers who can identify with that same situation I found myself in to see Simon's dad and say, oh, no, there are situations like this where, you know, the dad is heavily involved and is an encourager and, you know, is telling you, hey, even if you're afraid, it's okay. Even if you're afraid to get up on stage and rap and everything is going to go wrong, it'll be okay. You know, I wish I had a dad to do that, but I'm happy making it so that Simon has a dad and that readers will have a picture of a dad with a dad.
Well, that's what, you know, as I said when I read the book, that's what captured me, really. I thought, I mean, I didn't know your personal situation, but I thought, oh, wow, I love this dad. I love the way he talks to his son. I really brought tears to my eyes. The way, you know, you write, Dad always lets me be quiet when I don't have words. He never makes me feel like I gotta know what to say all the time. And when I read that, those sentences, really, I got tears in my eyes. I thought, this is so beautiful, and it's such a lovely thought. And I fell in love with Simon's dad. I thought, what a wonderful guy. And I'm glad that you wrote it like this, and so that people can see and children can see that how very important it is to have a great dad.
Yeah, no, for sure. Have a great dad. But I even try to incorporate that approach in my teaching. What makes my scholars special? And what is that thing that I can blow up and make a very big deal about to them? For Simon, it's silence. So if I can even say a little bit, he says, sometimes silence is key. I can be in my head where my thoughts can be free. What's cool is I don't have to speak. I don't have to be shaking or sweating or weak. Because the thoughts in my head are complete. I know just what to say, how to make it sound sweet. Nobody can hear it but me. Yeah, nobody can hear it but me. Simon's safe space is in his head. So for his dad to be able to realize that, for a teacher to be able to realize, what is your safe space, Patsy, and how can I blow that up and make it a big deal in my mind and respect your boundaries, man, I think that is huge. And it can be so impactful. And then you'll look back years down the line and say, I appreciate that that person made this a big deal about me, because it was a big deal to me.
Well, I think you write the parts about the family, about friends, about you're such a strong writer, and it really comes through. And the storyline, explain the storyline. Why, what does Simon do special that happens in this story?
Yeah, so again, Simon is an 11-year-old Black kid from the west side of Chicago, and he's small for his age, and he has a really big head, and those are some things that make him insecure, and he gets bullied often, and instead of speaking up, he kind of cowers, and that makes him ashamed of himself. It's sad that his friends Maria and CJ have to keep sticking up for him, because Simon says, like, I should be the one sticking up for myself. But when his teacher, Mr. James, assigns an oral presentation that Simon has to speak in front of the class in the first week, of course, Simon feels like, oh, no, this is going to go awry. I'm going to make a big fool of myself. But throughout the course of the story, Simon uses rap to kind of map out his next steps in life. That's his superpower. He's always thinking of how to make sense of the world, but it just so happens to rhyme in his head. So, you know, when he comes across, you know, an unlikely friend in that of someone struggling with homelessness, Sonny, he begins to see that, oh, Sonny's got some things on the outside that could turn people away. Sonny's got some things that could make people turn up their nose and say, not for me. Sonny's got some things that people could bully him about. And Simon's able to put himself into Sonny's shoes, in a sense, because he's got things that people bully him about. He's got things that he's afraid of. So in developing that relationship with Sonny, this person struggling with homelessness, Simon begins to develop a confidence because he sees, oh, Sonny is confident. That brother can sing. So maybe I should utilize my superpower to make the change that I want to make. And, you know, throughout the course of the book, he increases his confidence level and, you know, realizes, no, I can make a change in my community, and I'm going to do that. So that's really the core of Simon's story.
Well, it is a wonderful story, beautifully told. And as I said, you know, I don't know if this is a trend. I don't know if you're the only authors whose book I got that is written like this, where you use, I don't know what it's called anymore. You know, I was wondering, you know, when you found a publisher and I know Little Brown and Company published it, I was thinking, what would their editor have done with your book? Because an editor couldn't, I don't think they have an editor who could handle your book because the language is, I would say, so natural in many ways, you know, many ways that I don't think they have people there who could write like this.
So my editor was really cool. Shout out to Sam. My editor, I think it's like with anything. You have to get to know someone so that you can then extract the best parts of that person. So in getting to know me, Sam did a great job, and those at Little Brown did a great job, because they knew what I was trying to communicate. You know, the way that I talk when it's most authentic is like this. I talk like this, and I communicate myself like this. And at the end of the day, you are going to get my message because it's real, it's authentic, and it's not all tailored up. And it might not sound correct or grammatically correct, but the great thing about Little Brown Young Readers and then Sam, my editor, is that they were able to work within what I was giving them. And, you know, that's what I try to do with my scholars. That's what Mr. James, the teacher in the book, did with his scholars. What do they bring to the table? And how can I celebrate and build them up in this? And, you know, that's what it looks like with the writing. Oh, you gonna rap every few pages? Okay, we just got to figure out how to make it work.
Well, it does work. It's really, it works on so many levels. I think that for now, I don't know. Do you feel that all children will understand what you're writing? I don't think it's just for Black children.
Yeah. So, man, I think, as I'm sure you know, man, children are way smarter than we've historically given them credit for. I think their awareness is higher than mine was when I was at that age. And I definitely think that this is for all children. So the purpose is specifically written to highlight and celebrate Black kids and their stories. But I feel like having this diverse literature can expose all children to situations or circumstances or ways of life that they might not otherwise be familiar with. And that can expand their capacity to be compassionate. That can expand their capacity to be empathetic. I think the more we understand, the better we're able to operate.
Well, I think all kids will get it. As you said, they are smarter than we are in many ways, and I think they'll get it. And I think my boys knew rap. As you know, when my 5-year-old can tell me that I'm pathetic, because that's just, he said, that's just rhyming. That's not rap. Okay, don't tell me this, little monster. But, you know, I think it's great. You know, I have this policy. It's good that it's March, because I made this a policy a few years ago. I was only getting books from people of color for February. 1 month a year, publishers would send me books for February. And I wouldn't get books from people of color any other month of the year. And I said, oh, no, that's not right. I can't do that. I can't just say February is the month that I'm going to do books of people from, you know, different, not all colors. And so I don't do interviews with people of color in February, but I do interviews with people of color 11 other months of the year, you know, because I think this is important that people, you know, have this wide and diverse range of material available for them to read. And as you said, to learn and to understand other people. And I think a lot of kids will just really love this story. And I think all of them will be touched by, you know, as you said, you had a very strong mother. And, that's so important. I think that the children who read this book will understand that just having somebody to love and somebody to love you is so important in life.
I appreciate your efforts to include, you know, authors of color throughout the entire year, particularly Black authors throughout the entire year, because our story isn't just meant to be placed in a February box.
Exactly.
You know, Black people. Our story is ongoing, so us being able to have opportunities to communicate our stories ongoing, to be evergreen. So I think that I appreciate you for doing that. And even thinking about women's history or celebrating women, we're celebrating women this month. I think we should be celebrating women every month.
Exactly.
And, you know, my mom, every chance I get, I try to speak about how dope my mama was, because she really was. Even in the beginning of my book, I write, "Moms, thank you for taking us to all those libraries and bookstores. This is for you. Love, Mookie." Like, women are making change and have been making change for forever. And I don't think that it should just be for a day or for a month that we highlight and celebrate that. We should always be highlighting and celebrating those things.
Exactly. Well, I think, Duane Reade, the book is wonderful. It's called Simon Been Rhyming. And where can people see you? You're on Twitter. Explain where people can find more about you.
For sure. People can find more about me on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Teach Mr. Reade. You can find my email. Shoot me an email. I love speaking with people. Yes, I have a big head, but that don't mean I'm big-headed. I will reply to you. And if you want to send me some snail mail, it's okay. You might just get it back 6 weeks from now.
Okay, well, it's at Teacher Mr. Reade. And it is, you are adorable. Your mother must just be, well, you know, I love guys who appreciate their moms. And so, it's wonderful. And she must be very, very proud of you. You've done a wonderful job here with this book. And you're making a difference in the lives of so many students that are now finding you. And of course, I know that you're also helping a lot of teachers across the country to understand better the how to deal with children and how to talk to children. And I think that's very important, the work that you're doing.
Well, I thank you for that. And I also want to thank teachers as well, especially during this past year. Thank you for sticking in it and for teaching your style as well and loving them during this time. And I appreciate you for having me on the show, Patsy.
Okay, well, it's been a joy, and I'm sure then you'll have another book, and we'll have you back here on Joy on Paper. Okay, Dwayne?
For sure. Thank you so much. See you guys.
Okay, bye-bye now, Dwayne. Wow, what a guy. Oh, he's so cute, too. He's adorable to look at. He's a little doll. Okay, well, that's, you know, it's fascinating. I'm telling you, it did take me a little time. Because, you know, as you get, you know, kids will jump right into this book and they'll find all the, they'll understand it all. And it took me a little time, you know, that editor in me, I wanted to correct every little thing, but he's right. He wrote it so that kids will understand and kids will appreciate about doing good, and that's what Simon does. Simon does something great. I know that it's been terrible, terrible to think about the homeless people during this this cold spell that we've had across the country. I know that even here in Florida, where, you know, it's been really cold in the nights, I worry constantly about them. So, you know, check with your local people where you can donate money, where you can donate clothes, where you can donate blankets, and just help out with the problem, because it is a problem, and it's a shame that in this country where we have so much, we still have so many people who are homeless. And it's up to us, you know. And with this pandemic, people are not going out as much. People are not going to their churches as much. People are not going to their synagogues, and where they would normally make donations, or they would be having clothes drives, food drives, and things like that. But there are areas that you can help, and make sure that you try to find them, because it is tough out there. Even in Florida, where we've been having a run of cold weather, but luckily it's back and a little bit much nicer. I was just talking to somebody again up in Montana who had -6, so you never know. But you can keep yourself warm by writing, because remember what I always tell you. One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper, or to hear your words spoken in an audible book, or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, a streaming video, or perhaps a series on the Hallmark Channel, like I'm hoping for Carol J. Perry, Witch City Mysteries. Make sure that you go and get one of her books. Wonderful, wonderful. They will keep you warm. And I want to, again, say something nice to somebody today, and I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Big Ed. Thank you for keeping this place all germ-free and clean and organized. And he's saluting me, and I'm saluting him. And I really should have been a general. I would have been a great general. Okay, everybody, have a nice weekend, and write a book already. Get busy. Bye-bye.